This is an AMI podcast.
Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV. Good morning. It's Thursday, March the 30th, 2023. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Coming up on the show today, you could ask yourself a whole bunch of questions about going to post-secondary education. As you make those preparations, John Lepke and I want to share some thoughts on how you can best prepare yourself. And Jenny Bovard will explore the... And here's a question for you. Are technology trends moving so fast that you can't actually enjoy them? Stephen Scott from Double Tap Canada will contemplate that. That's also going to be our daily poll. But before you get to the poll, you know where the show starts every day. It's the top story of the day, and that's still lots of reaction to share from the federal budget. Let's start with the politics. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh says the budget is a reflection of his party collaborating with the Liberals.
Yesterday's budget shows that when New Democrats have power, we get things done for people. That's what it's shown, that we use our power to make people's lives better.
Conservative finance critic Jasra Singh Hallan expressed a less optimistic view of the budget.
The Liberals think everyone is stupid, that we should join in on their war on work and on paychecks, that we should support their failed inflationary policies. We're not gullible like the NDP. We're going to stand up for Canadians every single day.
Despite concerns about the $40 billion deficit, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says Canada's overall debt situation is stable.
We're one of the three largest economies in the world with a AAA credit rating, which means that our plan is responsible. It also is focused on delivering the healthcare supports Canadians need, as well as moving forward on the cleaner economy of the future with great jobs for the middle class. So this is the right budget for the time. We remain fiscally responsible, even as we're investing for a better tomorrow.
What about economists and analysts? What do they have to say about the budget? BMO Capital Markets chief economist Douglas Porter thinks this budget did very little to address the housing picture.
Last year was really the housing budget. It was the showpiece. That's where most of the efforts were trained, and it's almost like the focus moved on this year. Housing was very much an afterthought in this budget. It almost didn't get a mention.
The budget did promise $1.8 billion over the next 5 years to the Canadian Air Transport Security Authority to speed up security at airports. Aviation expert John Graddick says airlines will have to start being more transparent in sharing general passenger data to achieve this.
The airlines are basically saying that there is a need to keep the passenger count confidential for commercial reasons. What the government is trying to do is basically say, you know, the airports really need that information in order for them to basically staff their various functions properly.
And one more thread to pull at from the budget that emerged yesterday in some of the deeper analysis. The Canada Revenue Agency will pilot a new automatic system next year to help vulnerable Canadians who do not file their taxes get their benefits. Lori Paris has details.
The move toward automatic tax filing, first promised in the 2020 speech from the throne, is one of several budget measures the Liberals say are meant to help Canadians with the cost of living. Experts and advocates have called for automatic filing, noting many vulnerable Canadians miss out on benefits to which they are entitled. Canadians are generally not required to file tax returns every year unless they owe money, but the federal government is increasingly relying on the Canada Revenue Agency to deliver income-tested benefits to individuals. That includes the Canada Child Benefit, as well as the recent top-up to the Canada Housing Benefit and the temporary doubling of the GST tax credit. Lori Paris, The Canadian Press.
It's an interesting idea, and it's an interesting story. I don't know how much time you spend on your CRA folio or your CRA portal, the Canada Revenue Agency portal for your own accounts at the tax season. Most of the documentation you need is right there in the CRA's portfolios for you within your profile. So it makes you wonder, why couldn't there be an automatic filing? And then maybe you could go through a dispute process, or if there's some kind of complication that's not represented in your folio, in your profile, maybe that's where this would come into play. There really could be something said about the possibility of automatic tax filings. In a lot of cases, the tax money you pay is already taken off your paycheck. So CRA's already got that data. There is something to this. I don't know. We'll see how the pilot goes, but there is something to this idea of automatic filing. One more story for you, and this is a story that we've been following along for the past month or so, the protests in France. Well, the Paris sanitation workers' strike is over. Inez de la Couture has the story.
It may be bad news for Ratatouille, but welcome news for Parisians. Garbage collection resuming in Paris, with workers returning to work after more than 3 weeks. The strike was meant to protest the government's plan to raise the minimum retirement age from 62 to 64. The garbage collectors union, though, vowing to keep fighting. Close to 10,000 tons of trash had piled up on city streets, matching the weight of the Eiffel Tower. Another day of nationwide strikes and protests will be held next week. Inez de la Quatera, ABC News. Paris.
That's your look at the news. Let's get to the daily polls. At Accessible Media is where you can vote on Twitter. At Accessible Media Inc. is where you can vote on Facebook. Yesterday you were asked, how have current economic conditions impacted your view on cryptocurrency? 43% of you said a lot, 14% of you said a little, and 43% of you were entrenched in your position, not at all. Today's daily poll also dealing with the world of tech, and this will be something explored with Stephen Scott a little bit later in the show, in about an hour and 10 minutes or so. Is technology developing so rapidly that you find it hard to appreciate individual developments? Yes or no? At Accessible Media on Twitter, at Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook, things are moving very, very quickly. And it's interesting to me that something like the chatbot ChatGPT was here, and then the new version was out so quickly before even I could make it through the waitlist to play with ChatGPT, right? The waitlist was so long before something new came out that I never even got to log into it. And now there is a new chatbot released by OpenAI. So things are moving very, very quickly. So to a certain degree, yes, it's very hard to appreciate, especially some software developments. On the hardware side, that's a little bit more of a personal choice. If you want to update your technology every single year, you're welcome to do so if you can afford it. So maybe then you can appreciate either the LiDAR on the iPhones, or better GPS, or better cameras, or better earphones, or better microphones, or larger screens, or whatever you like. But that's a bit of more of a personal decision. Some of the software does move so quickly that it is hard to say, wow, I really got to hunker into that and enjoy it before I moved on to the next thing. But a lot of that's about your personal attitude. If you're a Luddite like me and a late adopter, then it's not really going to affect you. But if you're someone who likes to be cutting edge, maybe not dissimilar to the conversation we're going to have with Stephen Scott, or the ongoing conversation that I have with Mark Aflalo, the gang from Double Tap, maybe that changes the equation. Alex Smythe, I don't think we've ever pinned down whether or not you're an early adopter or a Luddite like me, but do you feel the technology is evolving so quickly that sometimes you can't stop and smell the pixels?
Absolutely, Dave. And I think I'm getting closer to the Luddite version that you subscribe to, but there are still some things, you know, that I get excited about. I try to get early on. You know, I was one, I got my new Xbox, like the first day it was released, you know, I was excited about that, did the pre-order for it. But that was something where I knew, okay, I bought this now, I have it for a life cycle of at least 5 to 7 years before a new system comes out. I can spend my time, I can invest in it. I don't need to worry about constantly updating, upgrading. Everything is going to be functional within this device that I purchase for the next 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. And that's really mm-hmm. what I try to invest in technology, devices, software that I know I have time to enjoy it. Because that's the thing. It's like, as soon as you buy some pieces of technology or some softwares, it's already outdated by the time you get it home. And those are the things where it's like, well, why am I even bother trying to get the latest and greatest when there's already one coming out like the next month, the next year? It's almost exhausting trying to keep up with technology. And it's like, I'm not a huge tech head. I like to keep up to speed with what's happening, be in the know. I don't need the latest and greatest of things, really. I'm fine, as we had talked about, I think, last week. I'm fine getting things that are a year old when it comes to the hardware side.
Yeah,
you know, you get good value from it. It's still good technology. It's still an upgrade from what I would have had before, but it doesn't need to be the latest and greatest, because trying to chase that kind of that train, you're never going to win, because it's always going to keep moving.
Alex, I think one of the commonalities between you and I is we're fairly simple people, right? Our needs are fairly simple. But I do wonder sometimes, especially when we're talking about technology in the disability space, whether rightly or wrongly, I would say sometimes wrongly, technology is oftentimes considered one of the big accessibility barrier breakers, right? That you're going to use tech to break barriers. So I do wonder about that mindset of chasing the latest and greatest when it comes to some of that technology from an accessibility point of view. Again, I'm going to argue that we should be looking at more structural ways to break barriers rather than Band-Aid solutions via $1,000 or $2,000 pieces of technology. But I do wonder how maybe accessibility and disability plays into some of that desire to say, okay, this LiDAR on this iPhone is great, but how can I make this LiDAR better so it gets even better at scanning a room to develop inside GPS and inside navigation?
Yeah, you know, those are all great points. I would speak to myself with my hearing aids. Like, that is the most expensive piece of accessibility equipment that I have used and continue to use throughout my entire life. And I will admit, mine are actually quite old in the life cycle of hearing aids. They're at least 5, if not like 6, 7 years old.
Oh, wow.
At this point. So they are quite old. They're due for an upgrade. I've been putting it off just because there's such an adjustment period, especially when it comes to hearing aids. And it sounds weird, but you have to get used to a completely different sound every single time. It is such a hard adjustment that it's a struggle for almost 2 months to really get yourself up to speed, comfortable with using a new set of hearing aids. And it's like the technology, I mean, it's going to be leaps and bounds forward. You know, the connectivity of them, the adaptability of them is far greater than what I currently have. But, you know, it's that hesitancy, because it's like, well, I don't want to have to get used to something new that's going to take such a long time to get caught up, to get comfortable with, that I'm holding on as long as I can with my hearing aids. But I know in the back of my mind, okay, maybe this is the year I have to do it. You know, I go to the audiologist, they're like, yeah, there's no warranty on these anymore. You know, it's going to cost you more money to repair them. It's like, I know, but I'm scared of upgrading in the future.
Is that like the eyeglasses that I have on that I've had for 13 years that I'm just so unwilling to replace? Because I'm like, they fit my face and they work. Why would I go spend you money? Although my eyeglasses, I wouldn't exactly call off. High tech, even though a beautiful slimming technology used by the Montreal Association for the Blind, so my lenses are not the size of Coke bottles. Alex, thank you for this. We'll pick up on this conversation a little bit later in the show. Stephen Scott will be here from Double Tap Daily. So in about an hour and 10 minutes, we'll explore the notion of whether or not technology is developing so rapidly that you find it hard to appreciate the individual developments in the moment. In the meantime, you can vote on the poll at Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook and at Accessible Media on Twitter. Let's go back to Alex for the national weather update.
Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. We're going to start off in St. John's, Newfoundland today, where it's a mix of sun and clouds. The high is +4, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel like -12 this morning. In Halifax, Nova Scotia, it's a mix of sun and clouds turning to rain or snow this afternoon. The high there, 4 degrees. In Montreal, Quebec, it's sunny, becoming a mix of sun and clouds near noon. There's also wind gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour. The high is +1, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel like -18 this morning. So winter is still not done with Montreal. In Ottawa, Ontario, similar conditions. It's sunny, becoming a mix of sun and clouds later. There's wind gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour. The high is +2. That wind chill, -19 in the Ottawa area. It's a bit warmer as we make our way to Toronto, where it's clear, becoming a mix of sun and clouds later. There is a high of 6 degrees, but the wind chill makes it feel like -11 this morning. In Thunder Bay, Ontario, it's mainly sunny, a high of +3, a wind chill of -15. In Winnipeg, Manitoba, it's a mix of sun and clouds, a high of -3, with a wind chill of minus 22 this morning. To Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, it is mainly cloudy with a chance of snow. The high is minus 2, but the wind chill is only minus 14, which is quite an improvement over the last few days, which have been the 20s and the 30s below, so starting to warm up in Saskatoon. It continues to warm as we head to Calgary, Alberta, where it's a mix of sun and cloud and clearing near noon. There is a fog advisory in effect this morning due to heavy fog in the area, but that'll be clearing up in the afternoon. The high is plus 4, the wind chill minus 9. In Edmonton, Alberta, it's cloudy with possible snow this morning, but then that'll clear up in the afternoon. The high is plus 5, the wind chill minus 8. Up in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, it's a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of snow this morning. The high is minus 10, the wind chill minus 26. To Vancouver, BC, it continues to enjoy beautiful spring days. It's mainly sunny today and a high of 13 degrees. Very similar conditions in Vancouver, in Victoria, BC, where it's mainly sunny, slightly cooler with a high of 12 degrees. And that's your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Alex. Coming up after the break, you've decided that you want to go to college or university. Okay, we can check yes on that box. But there are a bunch more questions that you can ask yourself to prepare for that post-secondary move. John Lepke and I will share some thoughts on how to best prepare yourself. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. The preparation in regards to post-secondary education never ends, whether you're a returning student or whether you're a new student. It's crunch time to make decisions about where and what you might study next year. John Lepke and I got to talk in last week about the value of pursuing higher education. If you missed that conversation, you can find it on the podcast. It was last Wednesday's show in the second hour. But we never quite got to discussing the questions you could ask yourself once you've decided to go to university or college. All right, John, ready to get back into this topic?
Absolutely, ready to jump back in.
All right, let's break these things down a little bit. What questions should somebody ask themselves before deciding what to study?
Yeah, I think for me, there's two key distinctions. There's the distinction between, are you going to do a degree that requires going to university, something like wanting to become a teacher or an engineer or something like that? Or, is it something that that I don't want to say can wait a while? I think that's really the distinction. The other thing that I would say is I think we have this perception still, how long have universities been around, that once you go into one degree, you are locked into that degree and that is what you are doing. And speaking as somebody who transferred in his undergrad and then went to grad school, I think really deciding what you want to do, but also keeping in mind that that's not the be all and end all, at least in Canada, is really important for students who have decided to go off to post-secondary.
Yeah, I didn't declare a major until much later into my undergrad experience, knowing full well that I could take a bit of a hodgepodge. I would say you should ask yourself, especially early in that undergrad or college degree, am I going to enjoy studying this, right? Unless you've got a clear path in your brain, unless you know you want to go to med school and you're going into pre-med and you say, these are the requisites that I need, I would say for the first year, it's worth saying, am I going to enjoy this? Am I going to get something out of this? What do I want to get out of this? And there's a differentiation here. I know when I went to radio school as a mature student at 25 years old, I knew that I wanted to work in the radio and broadcast industry. And it was very clear to me that I was going to study in a specialized program. When I was 19 years old and leaving CEGEP and going to university, I was thinking, what do I kind of think might be interesting or broaden me as a human, right? And I think that matters. And your socioeconomic position, it may influence that a little bit. You may have less time to waste if you need to pay off a student loan or get into the job market as quickly as possible. But I do think that asking yourself, am I going to enjoy this, is certainly worthwhile.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I happened my first 3 years of a degree. I mean, I picked education because I wanted to be a teacher from sort of age 11 and 12. I got over the idea that I wanted to be an NHL hockey goalie. I'll let listeners imagine what a wheelchair using NHL hockey goalie would look like. But anyway, got over that. I have a history of picking professions that perhaps aren't all that accessible. Before that, I think I wanted to be a postman. Again, wheelchair user trying to go upstairs for a living is a really interesting choice.
I like the ambition. I like the ambition, though.
Oh yeah, misplaced ambition is it, that could be the name of my memoir. So you know, it took me 3 years of an education degree to realize that I really like teaching and I really hate ableist systems, and teaching students is. At the you know, elementary and high school level, for a disabled teacher, is the definition of an ableist system. And so I picked English. I'm not sure my professors at the time would love me saying this on air, but I picked English mostly because I was doing more and more journalism, and it was the degree that I could finish the fastest. Yeah. Grad school came in as an understanding once I actually started to enjoy the English degree, but it wasn't exactly the it wasn't exactly the first impulse. So, you know, there's the fear of transferring and there's also the fear of failure. I mean, I think I have, technically I have 4 failed classes on my transcript and I'm about to get my MFA. I think things are less, there's a lot more gray area in how to thrive in university. We can get to whether I actually thrived, you know, later in this interview, but, there's a lot more gray area than I think people realize.
The road is long. The academic road is long, and there's going to be some road bumps along the way. John, what about this question? What question should somebody ask themselves about where to study? And I'll throw a little more preamble on this one. Sure. One of my big regrets is that I did not leave Montreal to go do my university education. Maybe I would have still stayed in the province. Maybe I would have gone to Bishop's University in Lennoxville. Maybe I would have gone to Quebec City, or maybe I would have gone somewhere close by like Ottawa or Kingston, you know, Queens or something like U of O or Carleton, because I will say now a lot changed in my life between 19 and 25 when I came back as a mature student. But I do think that I got caught in a little bit of an arrested development staying in my hometown during my undergraduate degree, that I was pretty comfortable and cozy in my bubble. So I would say that you should ask yourself a question before you decide where to go. Is it worth maybe getting out of my comfort zone? What about you? What are some of the considerations about where to study?
Yeah, for sure. So for me, I decided to stay in province, but 3 hours away. Actually, the reason that I left the area that I now live and went to the University of Regina is that at the time, an education degree, only Regina was offering direct entry rather than having to do 2 years of undergrad. And I knew for myself, even though I wasn't diagnosed yet with my anxiety and panic disorder, as I collect diagnoses like Pokemon, I knew I couldn't do 2 years without stressing over every mark as to whether I would get into education. Like, I'd known from the age of 13 that I wanted to be a teacher. I was not exactly a fan. And also, I was born in Britain. A lot of my family is British, and they're starting to shift, but more of a tradition to move away from university for university. I mean, the one thing I would say that I think often gets lost in this conversation when we talk about disabled folks is the mountain of effort that it is to set up a care team in a new place. I think I would qualify under Supercrip at the time that I went to go to university. You know, I was still training full time as an athlete. So I didn't put a lot of stock into, I was like, oh, you know, the campus medical clinic will be fine. I don't have any intense follow-up or whatever, but you know, if we're talking about shifting health regions and finding a new physio and finding a new community, I had Parasport community to lean on when I moved. So I think I was lucky in that way, but I think that is one thing that disabled students, I don't think it should preclude you, but I do think understanding things like, how do my disability benefits shift if I move provinces? What is available in my new province? When do I become eligible if I am moving? What kind of accessible housing is there? For example, I lived on campus for longer than I probably needed to. Part of that was getting a job on campus as a RA, residence assistant. Thank you, U of R residence team, for believing in me there. But, you know, part of that barrier was being unsure about what moving off campus could look like.
John, that's such a great systemic barrier to highlight. I don't mean that the systemic barrier is great, but it's great that you highlighted it in the sense that where are these gaps in terms of moving province to province and disability supports that may vanish for 9 to 12 months if you go away? Or what kind of bureaucracy are you going to be dealing with in those first couple months at school when maybe you should be trying to enjoy yourself or enjoy your studies, and instead you're in line at government offices day in, day out, being like, which form do I need to hand in to make sure I get this disability support? That's something that's very, very important to highlight. John, I'm going to Frankenstein these next two questions together.
Sure.
Because they both have to do with sort of the way in which you may roll out the timeline of your education. Because some people may be inclined to take a gap year, either before they start their post-secondary, or maybe right in the middle of their post-secondary, or they might do what I did about midway through my undergrad, which was shift from being a 5-class-a-semester student to a 4-class-a-semester student. And frankly, if McGill had offered part-time opportunities, I probably would have moved to an even bigger part-time model midway through, because I was stressed and I was burnt out. What do you make of people maybe playing around with those timelines, whether it be gap years or reducing the course load?
Yeah, so I think gap years are... I didn't take one. I didn't even take one between undergrad and grad school. So take this with as much salt as is required. I think gap years are a really great idea. I think in other parts of the world, again, Britain and Europe, they're more of a tradition and more understood as a good thing. From my experience, I think there is something to be said as well for... you know, wanting to get out on your own, even if you are staying in the city in which your family lives, just having that experience. As for changing the timeline, I think there's still this perception that everybody takes full-time classes and that if you're in part-time, you're behind and da-da-da-da-da. When the reality is the majority of students aren't, right? They are working. Mm-hmm. They are... many more people are broadening out their extracurricular activities, broadly defined, so that they, because when you get a degree, nobody cares if you had a 95, right? They care what you did outside of it. Mm-hmm. What did you do to broaden your experience and broaden yourself? I mean, I think, you know, not to speak for AMI, but I think that is... correct me if I'm wrong, you know, part of the goal of the scholarship program that you're you advertised after our segment last week. I think it's really important, as you pointed to think about what kind of life you want to live, not what classes you want to define how you live. I learned a lot of things in classes, but it's realistically the people that I met and the opportunities that I have that impact me today, yeah. Not the mark that I got in philosophy 150.
But you can talk a lot about Immanuel Kant, so that's important, you know, because we can't always get what we want. John, I do want to pick up on that thought, though, because going back to what I mentioned about sort of changing my course load in the middle of my education, that was specifically so that I could take a part-time job on campus. It was specifically so I could get more involved with theater on campus. It was specifically so I could volunteer off campus coaching kids hockey, because what I found those first 2 years of my undergraduate degree is all I was doing was either studying or drinking, and there was like nothing in between. and that's what I kind of realized. I was like, oh my gosh, this experience is going by really, really fast, and I'm not getting anything out of this that's rounding me out as a human. And you're absolutely right to identify that just because it might take you 4 years or 5 years through an undergraduate degree, sorry, I'm, I'm putting a Quebec lens on that because 3 years is the average length or the prescribed length of a full-time student getting their undergrad in Quebec. So if it takes 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, it doesn't mean that you're a lesser student. It means that you may just be a more well-rounded or Renaissance individual, or maybe you just have other interests that make you more fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe maybe you are, that is just what your body needs to get through. And I think what we don't tell particularly disabled students is how to, it's going to sound very MFA of me, but grieve an imagined future. Like, it is difficult to see your cohort graduate year after year after year while you're still doing classes that they finished 3 years ago and they've moved on to the next stage of their life. But I think that, how we perceive the way in which we exist at university really frames how we view disabled people and knowledge. And and I think that requires an increase in how we understand care, whether that's sort of the barriers at centers for student accessibility or whatever, which campus you go to, however they name it. I think it's all part of the same whole of understanding that full-time isn't the only way to do it, and that if you need to take two classes so that you can feel okay in your body, you know, let this very loud disabled person from Saskatchewan tell you that's an okay thing to want.
Let this person from Quebec and Ontario also tell you that's definitely okay. Take your time and enjoy it, right? I'll keep coming back to this word, enjoy it, enjoy your time. John, along those lines, if you could do it all over again, what do you think you would do differently?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I've been pondering it since our last discussion on air. Hindsight being 2020.
Of course.
I think I would try to do a better job of exploring opportunities outside of this laser focus I had for 3 years of, I want to do an education degree. All I can be is a teacher. I mean, my essay to get into education, the Faculty of Education at the University of Regina, was essentially, I'm disabled, let me change the world. I think I had a pretty 18-year-old's view of what a teacher could do. So I think, you know, it was really, really tough for me to switch degrees after those 3 years, because I built into my identity that I was going to be a teacher. And I found it very difficult to see myself. I see myself still as a teacher now, just in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think, if I could do more work to extract my identity in that, and actually it would have made the shift later a lot easier. But I think the parts that made my university experience hard, because my university experience has been very hard, I don't think I can hide from that, has been, again, outside of my wonderful supervisors and some people along the way, has been a remarkably ableist experience. And so I think it's important for me as a disabled student to hold on to the good things. I wouldn't have my career without working at the student paper, the Carillon, for example. I jokingly mentioned Philosophy 150. I think I've said on air to listeners before, I became a journalist because of the person who I sat next to, who happened to be the editor in chief of the paper in that first class. Like, there are things that happened. But I think when we get too laser focused into our identity, it can make it really, our identity as whatever we want to be after university, it makes it really difficult to navigate the ableism that you will run into.
Yeah, I have an ableist thought as well, John. One of the mistakes I made at McGill was not approaching the Office for Students with Disabilities at all during the 4 years that I was there. I don't know if it was pride or lack of understanding in my own disability identity at the time, but I think about some simple things. Like, I know a lot of accommodations are not met anyway, even when you reach out to the office, but I do think I don't have any idea why I was trying to read 8-point font reading materials with my magnifying glass, which was still difficult, when I could have gotten those in a large print if I had approached the office beforehand. I don't know what it was in my mind that said, oh, no, you can just persevere. You can hop over this barrier all on your own. In retrospect, I would have developed a more collaborative relationship, even knowing that it may not have solved all of my issues and barriers at school, but I think it would have made a difference.
Yeah, I think, and now I definitely was like, hi, I'm disabled. Please give me my disability card so I can wield it as required. However, I think for a lot of people that I talk to, and I'm not trying to prescribe it to you live on air, I think a lot of the people that I talk to, they are particularly told in high school, whether it's high school, CEGEP, or whatever system they come from, that you know, that this is the best it's going to get, that these very minimal supports are the things that are going to be available. And we get all of this, you know, to borrow Stella Young's term, we get all of this inspiration porn that tells us we can overcome. And I think at 18, I think it's a version of, or whatever age we go into university, but I think it's a version of that invincibility we feel as a young person of like, no, I'm better for overcoming these barriers. One's like, I think maybe, you know, whether it's large print for you or, you know, having an elevator that works and demanding that they move the class if the elevator doesn't work in my case, which is something I didn't ask for that I probably should have, is, you know, it is par for the course. And we're, you know, when we're accessing those services, flawed as they may be and extremely flawed as they may be, you know, we're, I mean, it's funny to make a call it standing, but we are standing on the shoulders of giants, of people who paved the path for us. And I think the more that we can do to make the system understand the changing frame of disability, whether that's from a blind VI perspective, wheelchair user, neurodivergent, wherever it is, I think that's how we can contribute to the university sector being more accessible for disabled students. And by the way, particularly for intellectually and developmentally disabled students who often get left behind in these discussions.
John, you and I've spent over 30 minutes in the last 2 weeks talking about this. Thank you for taking this deep dive with me.
You're very welcome. We could probably talk for 30 more.
We probably could. You know. Well, we'll revisit down the road. That's John Lepke, a freelance journalist in Saskatoon. I do want to remind you about those applications for the AMI Robert Pearson Memorial Scholarship. The application process is now open. The scholarship is open to Canadian citizens and permanent residents with a permanent disability. You must be currently registered in or returning to a full-time program of study at a Canadian post-secondary college or university. AMI will be awarding $2,500 bursaries, one to a student from the English community and one to a student from the French community, and each recipient will also receive a queen-size Tempur-Pedic ProAdapt mattress. For more information, visit ami.ca/scholarship. Coming up next, community reporter Blaine Deutscher will recap his experience at the 2023 National Blind Hockey Tournament. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. The 2023 National Blind Hockey Tournament took place this past weekend in Toronto. Community reporter Blaine Deutscher was there, so he's here to recap some of the happenings. Hey, good morning, Blaine.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Blaine, I'm well. I was very excited to hear you were taking part in the event, but before you even arrived in Toronto, before you even put foot on a plane, you were already making some arrangements with sponsors. What was that process like?
It was interesting because a lot of people still, even as big as Canadian Blind Hockey is, you still don't know what it is and who they are and how we play. So, working with partners like Saskatchewan Blind Sports really helped. And then having program managers and staff from Canadian Blind Hockey come out, they kind of cemented the partnerships, and we had 5 weeks of ice time for kids here, and got the Saskatoon Blades on board and the U of S Huskies, and so it went quite quickly.
Nice. Okay, so now you are on your way to Toronto. How was the travel experience?
Actually, it was really good. Both flights were full. And normally as a dog guide handler, they give you a second seat. And they did ask if I wanted it. And I said, no, the flight's, you know, super full. And my dog's a 70-pound shepherd. And I thought, oh, man, he's gonna take up some space. But he actually curled up really nicely. And people didn't even notice there was a dog next to him. So it was good. The flight was good. Things have definitely changed in the last 4 years, but other than that, it was really good.
Yeah. Anytime you get smooth travel, it's always a welcome experience these days. So, okay, Blaine, now we take you into Toronto. You get to the Mattamy Center, the old Maple Leaf Gardens where the event's being held. What did you think of the venue?
Honestly, every time you walk in there, it's a blast from the past. I took my fiance with me and, you know, I just pointing out in the Loblaws, the old seats hanging from the wall. Cause she's like, there's seats over there. I'm like, yeah, yeah. Those are where we used to sit back in the day. And it's just, I was enjoying the history of the center and, you know, making comments at the Mickey's, bar across the road probably was a hopping place back in the day, and we made it hopping again. But you know, it was just it's nice to always see the history. I love Toronto for their history, and even leaving, we had our concierge driver kind of point out some places, and my fiance took a bunch of pictures of old buildings and stuff, and yeah, I love it. It when you play on that ice, even though it's not on the same floor anymore, you just, a part of you is like, I'm here. I'm playing as an NHLer. So
you walk the paths and skate the paths of great men before
right.
you, great men and great women before you.
Exactly.
Blaine, let's talk about the tournament itself. How was the tournament? How'd it go for you?
It was good. So I got to play in two divisions. I played goalie, so I was the youth goalie, and I was on the Otters. So the Brantford School for the Blind has the Otters blind hockey team. If any youth or children are watching, their parents want to get their kids into hockey, the Brantford School has a team. So I played goal for them, and we won. And I also played on the low vision development, and the low vision development and the open divisions were named after the original six NHL teams. So I was a Hab. So with the Habs against the Leafs, and sorry, Leafs, you lost this year, but there's always next year. And so, yeah, we won, and it was a lot of fun. It's just nice to be able to get back on the ice after being away for 4 years. I really missed it. Yeah, we did quite well, and either way, I love the camaraderie. You get on the ice, you want to win. You get off the ice, and you go grab a beer, and I love that.
Mm-hmm. Any suggestions in regards to next year's tournament? Something you'd like to see, or something you'd like to see implemented in the next year's tournament?
I mean, the biggest thing, hopefully, one day will be a puck that constantly makes noise, because with the low vision and development, you've got, you know, deafblind players, you've got totals playing out. And as a goalie, when the puck stops, you're like, where did it go? And so it could be right in front of you. And to be able to, you know, hit it away to kind of keep the game in play, if you make a mistake like that, you don't know if someone is coming up who's going to hit it in, and you've moved your stick to try and find it. And at least if it was constantly making noise, you could say, well, hey, I hear it. I'm going to go and kind of whack it into a corner and let my defense maybe pick it up and skate it out. So that'd be nice, but it's improving every year. I mean, we had over 200 players out this year with Finland, England as our international players. We had Canada versus US this year. So, you know, it's growing. The women and The women's division is growing. So when they say hockey is for everyone, we mean hockey is for everyone. So,
well, Blaine, yeah. I'm glad you had safe travels. I'm glad you had a good time. All the best to you. We'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Yes, you as well.
That's Blaine Deutscher, community reporter in Regina, Saskatchewan. Coming up next, Jenny Bovard and I will explore the impact of the increase on alcohol taxes in Canada. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. I'm about to throw some lingo at you, but I'll translate it after I read this. This week's federal budget announced an increase in excess duties on alcohol products capped at 2%. Alcohol taxes are going up 2% across Canada. That's the translated version. There had been rumors the increase would rise to more than 6%. Here to offer some thoughts on the issue of alcohol taxes going up is Jenny Bovard, the host of the Low Vision Moments podcast. Hey, good morning, Jenny.
Good morning, Dave. It's my sigh of relief right there.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that. There were these rumors that it was going to be up to over 6% in regards to this, this tax increase on alcohol. But what's your reaction to it being capped at 2%?
Well, again, I am relieved. It was initially rumored to go up to 6.4%. So we are pleasantly surprised because the people, the businesses spoke out and we were actually heard. Initially, like you said, the increase was set to be over that, over 6%. And that's the largest increase ever. And where it really stems from, Dave, is in 2017, our government installed an automatic annual tax increase. So that would be paid by the producers of beer, wine, and spirits at the production level. But that tax was set to align with the rate of inflation, which we, most of us know, has been out of control lately. So to me, that system seems a little arbitrary, perhaps logical to have sort of it correlate with inflation, but it doesn't necessarily seem fair or maybe what's best for economic success when the additional cost is certain to be passed down to the bars and eateries and retailers and you and I, maybe me.
Yeah, the conversation around inflation was so different when that policy was put in place in 2017. At that point, we'd been going through a historic low point of inflation. So maybe the idea of tying some of these tax increases to inflation didn't seem as bizarre or odd. But then, as you point out, in a higher inflationary environment, all that's going to do is create higher pressures of inflation. And I think something we've learned is that although not everybody is a drinker, alcohol and bars and restaurants do make up a large proportion of the economy. That was certainly illustrated during the course of COVID. So Jenny, even taking a look at this 2% increase, what do you think that impact is going to be on producers and bars and retailers? Because to a certain degree, even at 2%, those costs are still going to be passed along, and those environments and businesses are still dealing with their own supply chain increases as well.
Well, the beer, wine, and spirit producers, the restaurant and bar industries, overall, the reaction is that this 2% increase is much more manageable, but it's still no walk in the park. Canadians already pay the highest taxes on alcohol in the world, second only to Japan. So Beer Canada also notes that there's been a 60% increase in barley prices, 40% increase in packaging costs, and doubling on the cost of freight and shipping. So it's still just making it more manageable. That 6.4% would have been much more difficult. The food service industry was saying that it would be something like $750 million a year we would be paying extra. And with restaurants, restaurants expected to pay like 30 grand extra per year towards their alcohol. So again, passing that on to customers, whether or not they're purchasing alcohol at a casual dining place or not. So I'm not about to attempt to do the math on all that, but again, the 2% might help our businesses stay afloat, those businesses who were and still are sort of trying to recover from the pandemic. The cost to buy from the liquor stores and from the brewers and wineries, it's still going to be less than going out to eat and buying liquor in the restaurant. So I think at the end of the day, the restaurants and bars are still unfortunately going to be the bigger losers in this whole thing.
So, Jenny, I understand your concern. You and I both wear pretty proudly our love of beer on our sleeves. We both enjoy it. It maybe sometimes, well, in my case, more than I should and more often than I should. But I do understand to a certain degree where these notion of vice taxes or alcohol taxes will come from, because there has been a lot of research done, particularly lately, the change to the actual guidelines on recommended alcohol consumption for Canadians about the health impacts of alcohol consumption. And Jenny, I always have trouble in these conversations around vice separating the issue of health issues connected to vice and the fact that we do live in a universal, or what is mostly a universal, healthcare system in this country. I do think that that is relevant in this conversation around vice taxes, that although I understand the blight, the struggle of the restaurant, I understand the struggle of the producer, I understand the struggle of the consumer, I also understand the struggle of doctors and nurses and surgeons and other healthcare professionals who are going to be burdened by an increase in health issues related to vice consumption, whether that be cigarettes, alcohol, take your pick.
I'm kind of with you where this is it's a difficult line to walk here, but if someone can prove to me that the additional taxes that I'm paying on my liquor, if someone can prove to me that that is being spent in a valuable way where my healthcare services are actually going to be improved, because let me tell you, this recent budget and this recent income tax that I filed, I don't see benefits for me as a person individually. Mm-hmm. There are some good pieces there in the budget, but if someone can clearly explain to me where my additional tax on beer and liquor is being spent and the direct correlation, I would be more on board, because in researching all of this, I found evidence both ways that taxing vices does work in some cases and some places it doesn't. I won't name specific countries, but studies have shown both that this works and that it doesn't in some cases. Yeah. So I don't know. I think if you can prove to me, if you can prove me wrong, I might be more on board.
Jenny, I like that. This is why I would gladly make you a vice president of Dave Brown Consulting, because that's one of the big things that I talk about. And I oftentimes reference the example of Colorado, the first U.S. state to fully legalize cannabis. They directly correlated the tax revenue to the education system. Whatever money was collected from cannabis went directly to the education system in a very tangible way. And you're right, there's something very murky about the way that provinces and the feds and the cities collect taxes without transparently showing you this is going there. So I am definitely on board with you that if you do want to put in these kinds of vice taxes, especially under the guise of universal healthcare, okay, let's see that money go to universal healthcare. Yeah, show me the work.
Yeah, show me. Yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you.
Jenny, thank you for this. Always appreciate your perspective, and thank you for reacting to this news story with me.
Hey, my pleasure. And I just have to say, this goes in effect April 1st, so get your cheers on today, tomorrow. And you know, the price of everything is going up. So I don't know, just let's all watch our wallets and where we're spending our money.
Yeah, let's all have a side hustle. Let's all get a side hustle going. Jenny, have a great weekend, and good luck rushing to the alcohol store tomorrow.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Jenny Bovard, the host of the Low Vision Moments podcast. Coming up after the break, I've got the regional news update, and Brock Richardson stops by with the sports chat. It is opening day in Major League Baseball. Play ball! This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV.
Hi, I'm Red Sale, inviting you to download the latest episode of My Life in Books, where internationally acclaimed authors discuss their lives, their work, and three books that have resonated with them. That's My Life in Books, available wherever you get your AMI podcasts.